Good morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Policy Division to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Morning, everyone. Frederick.
Present.
Frankie.
Present.
Backer. All right, Backer. Baker.
Baker's present.
Becker Finn. Becker Finn. All right. Hanson.
Present.
Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Lippert.
Present.
Moeller.
Present.
Pearson.
Present.
Thompson.
Thompson present.
All right, Backer.
Backer present.
And Becker Finn. All right, you're on mute if you're in there. All right, quorum is present.
Okay, thank you. Members, in the hearing materials you received in the email last night from Mr. McCall, you will find the division rules for this session. Most of the rules should look familiar to what is being done in other committees, but I do want to draw members' attentions to a few spots. First of all, rules 6, 7, and 10. For our regularly scheduled meetings, we will have a unified deadline of noon on Tuesdays for filing amendments and handouts, as well as signing up to testify. This will give Mr. McCall and Mr. Crowe's time to distribute all of this information out to the public and committee members by the end of the day on Tuesdays. While there will not be a formal deadline for amendments to amendments, I would ask that members provide Ms. Sutterman with as much advance notice as possible with drafting requests given our 8:30 start time. She is also staffing two other HHS committees and we need to be respectful of her time, so please keep that in mind. Rule 7, we are also going to allow members of the public to submit written testimony up to 24 hours after a hearing ends. This will this added ability for people to provide input will help address the needs of the public who might be listening on the day of the meeting and wanted to provide testimony. When we're in person, they're able to come down and testify. Providing a 24-hour window allows these people to have that same opportunity to submit the testimony. Are there any questions on the division rules? Okay, not seeing any questions. The next item on our agenda is review and approval of the division minutes for January 13, 2021. The minutes were included in the hearing documents that were emailed to you by the committee staff. Are there any corrections or questions on the minutes? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Okay, Representative Keith Frankie moves approval of the minutes of January 13th, 2021. Please unmute yourself frequently for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 Okay. All opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Excuse me. The next item on our agenda today is a presentation from an impressive coalition of state agency, health providers, and patient advocates and counties regarding the challenges that the COVID-19 pandemic has created in the behavioral health sphere, but also some of the lessons we have learned from that ordeal and how we can improve service delivery both during and beyond the crisis. We know that the pandemic has been a uniquely traumatizing experience for Minnesotans, increasing demand for mental health and substance use disorder services. But in our efforts to preserve access to care, we've also seen an incredible amount of innovation in service delivery that may not have occurred with the same speed in a more normal policymaking environment. So today, We will learn more about both parts of that equation from the people and organizations who most directly are engaged in behavioral health. And I want to thank the department for helping bring together all these voices so we can have a comprehensive discussion. As we move forward with the presentation, our first person will be Mr. Paul Fleschner, Director of the DHS Behavioral Health Division. As each person comes to testify, I would ask that they identify themselves, which organization they are with. And after each person is done presenting, I will take a brief moment or two to find out if there are any questions. I do want to remind people that we do have a very hard stop at 10 a.m. And so as we approach that time, I will apologize if I have to cut anybody off. And I also want to make sure we have enough time to get everyone to present. So at certain points, I may move us along a little bit quicker so that we get to hear from everybody. With that, Mr. Fleschner, if you'd like to go ahead, identify yourself and who you're with to start a presentation. And thanks for bringing this together.
Good morning, Chair Fisher and members. I am Paul Fleischner, Behavioral Health Director with DHS. I will reinforce Chair Fisher's comments. Having been at the local level before coming to DHS about 6 weeks ago, the changes that the state legislature made were game changers for us at the local level. Next slide, please. The slides are blinking at me, so they're okay. There we go. Today, we're going to cover what is behavioral health, impact of COVID-19, pandemic flexibilities, what we learned, policy agenda preview, and a national initiative called Medicaid Forward. My colleague, Clinical Director Neerja Singh, will talk about those things at the end and will follow me. So next slide, please. So what do we mean by behavioral health? Behavioral health includes adult mental health use disorder services for all ages. According to SAMHSA, behavioral health means the promotion of mental health, resilience, and well-being, the treatment of mental and substance use disorders, and the support of those who experience and or are in recovery from those conditions, along with their families and communities. Our division also works with gambling prevention and treatment along with tobacco compliance. So we have a pretty broad array of what we think of in terms of behavioral health. Some data that we were able to pull regarding medical assistance claims, just to see how fee-for-service and managed care organization claims were looking in the area of substance use disorder. As you can see, we've seen growth in that area in particular. And we've seen growth over the last year and a half in mental health as well. So you can see people under pressure, but I would also highlight this data is just through June. And we know we've seen the pressure build on people over the course of the rest of the year. So I think we know the numbers probably grew from there, but I don't have those numbers. The CDC did a study on mental health, substance use, and suicidal ideation from during the COVID pandemic. A couple of points we pulled out, Hispanic respondents were particularly hit with anxiety, depression, increased substance use, and suicidal ideation. Black respondents were hit with increased substance use and suicidal ideation. Unpaid caregivers for adults had higher odds of incidence of adverse mental health conditions compared with others. So we know there's disproportionality and it's hitting different populations in different ways. Next slide, please. Here, I think I turn it over to Dr. Singh.
Dr. Singh, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. This is Neerja Singh. I am the Clinical Director for Community Supports Administration at Department of Human Services. I will just kind of continue what Mr. Fleischer was talking about, as it is clear on the slide here that when comparing the current time period, what people are experiencing now to last year, there was a remarkable increase in all these symptoms of anxiety and depression. Next slide, please. And here I turn it over to Mr. Fleischer to talk about some of the flexibilities DHS had.
So under the governor's order, executive orders, DHS has temporary authority to waive or modify requirements, including medical assistance and Minnesota care coverage, where people were able to automatically continue their coverage. Telemedicine, we eased limits to increase access in terms of the rules and regulations. They expanded access to behavioral health services. Phone and video for targeted case management, which wasn't approved before, was allowed during the pandemic and still is. School-linked mental health, we created some flexibilities around as well. For example, I know in some schools they were allowed to do telemedicine and connections with various kinds of providers that they never could before. And extending those recertification timelines for mental health programs meant they didn't have to recertify. They could focus on the work, waiving licensing requirements for providers or rolling them over forward so they could stay licensed and moving and doing the critical work we needed them to do during the course of the pandemic. Next slide, please. We had grant management flexibilities. For example, in some cases, people needed to use some grant dollars to change their physical environments, and that helped them safely serve people. We provided a temporary staffing pool for residential providers. It wasn't completely successful, but it was helpful for some agencies during the course of the pandemic. Grant funding for behavioral health services included $3 million for providers who serve children and families, $1.68 million for crisis counseling services, $700,000 for community mental health service providers, $500,000 for health supports for American Indian elders. And there's been additional federal funding, as you know. What we learned from a DHS perspective. Again, I'm turning it back to Dr. Singh for this slide.
Go ahead, Dr. Singh.
Thank you, Mr. Flaxter, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to emphasize that these are like just a summary of what we learned during our journey while we were addressing the mental health and substance use needs of our clients in Minnesota. There were like huge issues around equity as far as access to mental health and substance use disorder treatment opportunities were concerned. Minnesota is facing, like rest of the nation, a workforce shortage in both, again, mental health and substance use fields, which makes it really hard for our BIPOC communities to connect with providers who can be culturally responsive. DHS currently is working on incorporating cultural responsiveness through national class standards across all our service lines, which will take some time, but we are hopeful that this would address some of the concerns that our providers and our enrollees are facing. As we mentioned, there are like confusing and unnecessarily complex statutory requirements when it comes to reporting of mental health and substance use disorder data. So we are, during COVID, we were able to add flexibilities to that reporting requirement. So we hope to continue analyzing those requirements through our uniform service standards work so we can address those complexities and encourage providers to focus more time on providing services to clients. Next slide, please. With that, I am going to turn it over to our partners, and we will start with March. So,
and before we move on to March, I would like to take just a quick second to see if anybody has any questions on this first part of the presentation. I'm not seeing any hands right offhand, but I do have one question. And I think, Dr. Singh, you might be the best one to answer this. You referenced that as you were going through the pandemic, there were some statutory things that needed to be modified to provide flexibility. The question I have, were those temporary or are those permanent? Or if they were temporary, are these things that we're going to need to see recommendations for policy changes coming from the department? Go ahead, Dr. Singh.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, some of those requirements were permanent in the statute, so we sought temporary. And you will see as we move on in our policy, one example is like in our assertive community treatment program, which is a community program for highly highly risky mentally ill clients to support them to stay in the community. One of the requirements was that telemedicine was not allowed for psychiatric care, and it was in statute. So we were able to waive that through our COVID flexibilities, and we hope to just kind of make it permanent because that really was an access issue and that helped. And there will be other policy changes that will be coming. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I see Representative Mueller has a question. Representative Mueller, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to our testifiers. I've been hearing about people who are needing to see their therapist, but they live in another state. They're from Minnesota. Perhaps they're in college and they're in another state and they're not allowed to receive those services because of the different laws in the different states. And I'm just curious if our presenters have any information about that.
I will open up who feels best qualified to tackle that issue. Dr. Singh?
I think I can take that, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, right now we were able to, again, add flexibility to the origin of telemedicine site. So during COVID, and we will be seeking that permanent change. So we were able to add that flexibility as like it can be from where the provider is and also where the student is. So, or the, because we had that concern too, like a lot of students were going home to different states and they were not able to access their providers. So we were able to kind of make that change, but I hear that there were concerns in terms of providers having to, they were not able to bill. I think Ms. Sue Eberholden will have some more information. So Mr. Chair, if I can have Ms. Eberholden add more information to this.
Certainly, Ms. Eberholden, if you could please introduce yourself and who you're with and then continue with the answer there, I would appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Eberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. This is an issue that I just looked into this week because we heard from several parents who were really concerned about this. It's your private insurance. So the state can do what it can under Medicaid, but private insurance often doesn't. And if we don't have reciprocity with another state for example, psychologists, then they can't practice, for example, in Iowa. So it is an issue. I know the psychologists have a bill to try to address that, but it is, I would say, pretty frustrating because you've already had a relationship with this therapist. Why can't you continue it? So, but unfortunately, that is happening under private insurance.
Thank you, Ms. Abedolden. I appreciate that. Representative Mueller, are there any further questions? Okay, hearing none, the next person we have is Representative Baker. Representative Baker, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. This question might be for Dr. Singh. And this, don't know if it can be answered now, but the one thing that we have heard for some time, and I wanna make sure we understand this better, is the bullet point on the last slide about the equity issues to access. I wanna understand that better. I wanna understand what is it that's causing access issues. Rule 25 is open for anyone who needs treatment and support, for example, in addiction support, and it's there for everyone. Is it public transportation? Is it transportation issues? So Dr. Singh, can you help me to really, if this committee is gonna deal with this issue openly, I wanna really try to get our eyes on the details of what's causing this issue access problem. So can you help me with that a little bit?
Dr. Singh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you so much. This is an issue that we at DHS and our stakeholders are also like kind of dealing with right now. And when I talk about our flexibility through telemedicine, it was really disheartening to see that the data showed that our BIPOC communities were not utilizing telemedicine as compared to others. Even with all the flexibilities, like you could just use phone. So besides like lack of support in accessing these services. One thing we are noticing is like stigmatization around mental health and substance use services in our BIPOC communities. We will be, as part of a telemedicine study, we will be conducting focus groups with enrollees, like Medicaid enrollees, that is part of the national effort, in addressing, identifying what are the obstacles and how we can address those. But right now, it is it was like, again, very disappointing to see that despite all the flexibilities in services, so people really didn't have to leave their homes to get services, our BIPOC communities really did not utilize telemedicine. So yes, with you, we will be looking at it in depth about it.
Okay. Thank you. Do I notice a hand up going from Sue Abderholden, who'd like to jump in on this issue too? Go ahead, Sue.
Thank you, members. Sue Abderholden. Representative Baker, one of the things that we know too is that if you don't have enough mental health or substance use disorder, you know, professionals from those communities, that can also make it difficult. If we don't have providers who are culturally informed and sensitive, that can make it hard for someone to go there. We know, for example, that Black men are overdiagnosed with schizophrenia. And part of it, they believe, is because they're misinterpreting kind of how someone is presenting. So I think that we have to, part of the reason that it's underused is because we don't have a culturally informed and culturally diverse workforce.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Thank you. And next I have Representative Franke. If you'd like to go ahead, Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I don't know who this question would be for, Commissioner Fleischner or Dr. Singh, but the telehealth, we know that there's increased participation because it's more easily accessible. Are we or do we have a way of tracking outcomes when it comes to the participation, whether it's being positive or can we come up with something like that to make sure that it's actually working? We know people are showing up, they're participating, but is the end goal being achieved? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And who would like to try to answer that? Am I seeing Ms. Dello? Why don't you go ahead and identify yourself and who you're with and take a shot at the answer there, please.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members and Representative Franke. My name is Amy Delwo. Today I'm here on behalf of MARCH as the co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee. However, I do work with New Way, which is a co-occurring substance use disorder treatment provider. We happen to be in the midst of a study with the University of Minnesota that started in August of 2019. And so later in this presentation, I'll give you a few of the notes about the outcomes that we have seen. We did a comparison of people that used televideo only, those that used a mixed modality, some in person, some in through telehealth, and then also those that had only in person. And a quick preview is that those that had a steady diet, if you will, of telehealth only did have better outcomes than those that were in person or mixed modality. And in fact, those that had a mixed modality outperformed both the in-person and the telehealth only. Wow. So that's what we're finding thus far.
Wow. Thank you, Ms. Delwald. That's interesting to know. This is great information. I'll look forward to your further details as we get in the presentation. I see one more hand up from Representative Becker Finn, and after that, we will continue on with the presentation. So Representative Becker Finn, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to follow up a little bit on the previous question. about folks, you know, our BIPOC friends and neighbors and access to care. And I think there are a lot of things, and I just want to make sure we're being really careful to not sort of blame the folks who are having trouble accessing those services. So I just want to make sure we're being careful in the way that we talk about it. You know, language is an issue. If English is a second language, it's not like we have a lot of providers that provide care in different languages. And then that cultural piece is huge. You know, if you feel like you can't find a therapist who's going to understand the culture that you come from, the amount of work you're going to have to do just to get to that base level of therapy being helpful to you is different. I think there are barriers in access to technology and reliable broadband. And I think as well, the folks from those communities are more likely to be impacted by the childcare issues that we see going on right now, you know, caring for elders and other folks in their household, as well as they're more likely to be frontline workers with non-business day schedules. And it just makes it harder to schedule. It makes all those things make it much harder. If you think about it, if you're six people living in a one bedroom apartment, how are you going to manage having a meaningful conversation with a therapist when there are that many people in a smaller space? So I think there's a lot of factors going on there, and I just want to make sure that we're thinking about all of those things as pieces that tie into that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Becker Finn, and thank you, everybody, for the questions we've had so far. Why don't we go ahead and continue with the presentation? If I'm understanding right, the next person that we're going to will be Ms. Delwo from March. If you'd like to go ahead, introduce yourself, who you're with, and continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my name is Amy Delwo. I'm here today as the March co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee. March represents 70 organizations and 2,000 professionals and students throughout Minnesota who deliver services across a continuum of addiction, treatment, and recovery. So we want to thank you for the invitation to be here today and your attention to this subject matter. Brian, my co-chair, and I wanted to highlight a few statistics for you that we thought would set the landscape of the COVID environment for people with addiction. So first off, according to the MMB economic update, the state revenues for addiction-related goods like gambling, alcohol, and cigarettes were nearly $37 million more than predicted simply in the months of July through September alone. And this is also seen as a national trend. Preliminary data by the Minnesota Department of Health indicates that drug overdose deaths in 2020 increased by 20% over that in 2019. And on a national level, the CDC reports that 2020 was the highest number of overdose deaths in this country at 81,000. And for some context, in 2018, at the height of the opioid epidemic, it was 67,000. And finally, the Association of Addiction Treatment Providers conducted a nationwide survey and found that 43% were forced to reduce patient capacity during COVID, and 10% actually shut down. So the high-level theme here is that at a time when we're seeing use and addiction amplified, that we're seeing a decrease in the capacity for those to serve, for the system to serve those in need. I have one client experience that I wanted to share with you, and then a few takeaways before I give it over to Brian. This particular client struggled for the first month in treatment to remain sober and use telehealth to check in and fulfill expectations of probation. Most days, he actually sat in a car while attending treatment due to the convenience of the internet access to his smartphone. And at this time, the client was minimally participating and was usually seen doing some multitasking throughout group session. The day that began the change in his treatment experience was when he was arrested on camera in the middle of group. And that client returned the next day, but continued to struggle with sobriety. Within a week after his arrest, he found out that the mother of his unborn child had died of a drug overdose. And he also learned of that while he was in the middle of group. At that point, he engaged and moved himself into a recovery residence, took major steps towards his recovery. And he was attended group every single day thereafter. Most times he tried to attend in-person sessions when his work schedule allowed, but otherwise he accessed the telehealth treatment because he traveled across the state of Minnesota for work. So the client reported back that he said he was able to work, he was able to attend treatment, he was also able to work on his recovery due to the accessible nature of telehealth services and virtual platforms. The client did successfully complete treatment in September. So although the client was not initially invested in recovery, he was tethered to treatment long enough that allowed him to become internally motivated. So a couple of takeaways that I wanted to give. One is that substance use disorder is a disease of isolation, and COVID has exacerbated that. In April, people were in recovery were craving connection. Sometimes clients live with others in recovery, and at times these roommates wanted to sit in, quote unquote, on group sessions. We know that people in recovery, they knew that they needed support to remain on their recovery journey. And so counselors at that time would redirect those roommates to resources that would meet their needs to keep the integrity of the treatment group. Clients have appreciated the ability to schedule other virtual appointments like medical and caseworkers. And they were able to do some of that because the time to travel to treatment was abbreviated. And ultimately, this yielded higher rates of treatment engagement that we've seen with the clients. And then by the time June came around, small in-person treatment groups of five or fewer were offered. And most of the clients we saw were the ones clamoring to be on site in those groups. And so that's a few takeaways. And just to quickly respond to Representative Baker, that I think the other thing that also yields some of those different outcomes is that different populations have access to different sets of recovery capital or levels of recovery capital and social determinants of health. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my co-chair, Brian, who'll tell you about the professional and organizational experience.
Thank you. Brian, Mr. Zerbes, if you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Zerbes, co-chair of MARCH's Government Affairs Committee. I also work with North Star Behavioral Health, a substance use disorder provider in Minnesota. So I'm going to pick up where Amy left off, talking about the experience for professionals in the field. You all would imagine, health and safety of the people we're serving was the number one priority for professionals. With uncertainty of COVID, the treatment field still recognized that addiction is a deadly disease if left untreated. COVID has required us to shift the ways we work with clients, both individually and in groups. Safety protocols have had a drastic impact on visitation, particularly for residential programs and outings going into the community and support groups in the community. Programs during this time have had to be flexible to continue to meet the needs of people with COVID while concurrently keeping other clients and staff safe. These professionals show their dedication despite the fact that many are older and may also have underlying health conditions. As a professional counselor in the state and as a provider, we all are very proud of the dedication that professionals have shown, both frontline workers and in serving our community across the state. The other aspect is on organizations. As you can imagine, the substance use disorder providers, the pandemic has had an adverse effect on substance use disorder organizations as well. In those early days of March, all providers had to learn, plan, and execute drastic changes in the way they did business. As the pandemic drew on, programs experienced staffing challenges due to a number of reasons, either due to staff not being able to work, when they are on quarantine themselves due to illness, when they're on quarantine for family members due to illness. Financial challenges also included additional purchases of personal protective equipment. Amy had touched on technology, purchasing laptops, purchasing equipment for and cameras to be able to allow safe participation, particularly for people on quarantine or for people living in sober homes. Additionally, many providers offered hazard pay for their frontline workers. But despite best efforts, many programs had to make the hard decision to close their doors. To reiterate the point that Amy made, nationally, 10% of programs had to close. Over the weekend, I ran a report on licensing lookup and was able to determine 24 licensed substance use disorder programs closed in 2020 alone. My last point I'd like to make is there is more need now than ever for substance use disorder professionals and organizations to support members in our community. We stand ready to be a part of the solution. And lastly, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair and community members for having us on.
Thank you, Mr. Zebus. Are there any questions for Ms. Delwell or Mr. Zebus? Okay, not seeing any hands going up at this point in time. I understand the next person that will be presenting will be Mr. Tim Huntner from Olmsted County Regional Program Coordinator. If you'd like to introduce yourself and go ahead with your presentation, sir.
Good morning, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. Tim Huntner, Regional Program Coordinator for our Adult Mental Health Initiative here in Southeast Minnesota, also known as CREST. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota Inter-County Association. So my role in our region is really a macro level focus of how we deliver mental health services to individuals living with serious and persistent mental illness. I work across systems to identify challenges and stressors on our system and plan strategically to make improvements. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk today about the impact of the pandemic on our behavioral health system. My goal is to kind of illustrate how COVID is shifting the way we provide services to those in need and illustrate the impact of stress on our system. I'll likely echo what many of the others have said as we continue to see the numbers of individuals struggling with behavioral health has increased during the pandemic. I'd like to start out by saying, much like the virus, the impact on the body, our behavioral health systems and communities have not been impacted by the pandemic the same way. Each of our counties and regions are unique in resources, infrastructure, leadership, and population. The speed and the ways in which our system has been able to adapt to our new norm and are really dependent upon these and other variables. That said, our mental health centers, counties, and providers across the state in conjunction with the Department of Human Services have really worked diligently to ensure individuals that need services did not experience a significant gap in care to the best of their ability. With waivers granted from DHS, counties have done their best with limited resources to continue to deliver really quality services. I am actually going to use stress as a framework to illustrate the virus's impact on our system and communities. In the mental health and behavioral health field, we talked a lot about the impact of stress on people, communities, and systems. And initially, we experienced acute stress from the pandemic, stay-at-home orders, the inability to deliver services the way we did before, forcing our staff and system to find resolutions quickly to care for those experiencing behavioral health challenges. The result was a need for an expansive assembly of waivers, state plan amendments, policies, procedural, and contract changes to ensure the work continues. The one thing I'll say is the acute stress on our system was not all bad. It really drew attention to a system that was not ready to adequately provide access to services and be as flexible and responsive as necessary. Counties have and continue to worry about these access issues for those seeking help. The acute stress showed how much work is needed to support our systems and update our policies surrounding behavioral health services. It allowed for some real-time observations of telehealth practices to occur, demonstrating that we can work efficiently in some areas to improve access where we couldn't before. I think of rural communities as a big one there. It showed our workforce is truly dedicated to ensuring the well-being of individuals experiencing behavioral health challenges, though stressed, and we obviously there's been mention of staff shortages. And we've been able to connect with folks and individuals remotely which is not ideal, but we have found some, many have found some support here during the pandemic and continued some crucial services. But the biggest issue I honestly see we're facing here is that the stress has really, really become chronic and unrelenting. And it is felt by all people in all parts of the system. We've had a year of closing businesses, struggling to find necessary PPE for providers and individuals, not being able to see that those that we serve and work with in person. We've been mining deep to find resources and technology and develop policies to keep our world moving forward. But when you start seeing, when you start with barriers and challenges with an imperfect system, it creates and makes coping with stress even more difficult. And so the unrelenting pandemic stress really continues to put immense pressure on our system. So we are seeing an increase in substance use and alcohol-related interactions with law enforcement, hospitals, county human services, and our community-based providers. Many individuals are isolating, not reaching out for necessary human connection, and coping with stress by turning to substances and other means. And honestly, there are big concerns. This is going to breed long-term effects on people and our health, and ultimately the behavioral health system for time and years to come. So people have been and continue to be hesitant to seek healthcare due to fear of infections. Putting off care allows for progression of illness, and our system is seeing more complex presentation of symptoms with greater need for support and services. We are experiencing limited inpatient capacity for behavioral health needs due to obviously our high level of medical acuity. We have not been able to move individuals that are stabilized to proper care settings due to issues surrounding the pandemic, such as infection control, quarantine, and a myriad of other variables. This continues to bog down our system for those needing other community-based services. Our crisis teams and call centers have continuously seen an increase in calls for mental health support, and this has no sign of lessening for many of our crisis providers. Just our call center, which covers 11 crisis teams since September, sees about an additional 200 calls, mental health calls each month, and it doesn't necessarily show any signs of slowing down. So this is really, we see it as a crucial pivot point for improving our mental health delivery system moving forward. Our counties, partners at the DHS, providers, and advocate groups have done well to respond to the sudden onset of the pandemic. The lasting impact of the pandemic, though, will be felt for years to come. And we need to ensure that access of services is maintained and improved for those facing behavioral health challenges. We need adequate funding through increased support to our mental health initiatives. We will need to have flexibility in policies and resources provided to counties as a mental health authority to support the system moving forward. We're going to continue to partner, obviously, with the Department of Human Services and explore further utilization of telehealth options and really try to shoot to kind of improve these and improve access after the pandemic is over. As counties, we strongly advocate for an increase of our block grants to allow for flexibility and reactivity when necessary. You know, we support the continuation of waivers that allow for greater flexibility and coverage for services delivered by phone and telehealth. We support modifications to SUD reform that would allow counties to conduct and bill for pretreatment screenings and peer support services. But please note, we know that resources are limited. We continue to kind of watch the action at the federal level to assess opportunities and access any future economic recovery dollars, and we encourage state legislators to be mindful of those opportunities as well. We encourage you to examine those dollars and use legislative authority to ensure that, you know, as possible, those dollars are distributed in a flexible way that meet the complex needs of Minnesotans that perhaps are suffering most in the pandemic. I really greatly thank you for your time, and know that I do talk fast, but I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody may have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Are there any questions for Mr. Hunter at this point? I am not seeing any hands going up right now. Mr. Hunter, thank you for your presentation, and there may be questions coming up yet, so if you can stand by, I'd appreciate it. And the next person I see that we have on the agenda to speak to us is Ms. Wendy Jones from Minnesota Recovery Connection. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself, Ms. Jones, and who you're with, and then start your part of the presentation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. My name is Wendy Jones. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Recovery Connection, And I'm here today to speak about Minnesota's recovery community organizations and their work during this time of COVID-19. Just a little bit of background. Recovery community organizations are grassroots nonprofits. We are not clinical, we're community-based. We exist solely to increase the prevalence and quality of recovery in our communities. And we really ascribe to a certain set of values and philosophies. One is that everything we do is person-centered and strength-based. We honor all pathways. We train people to become peer recovery specialists. So Minnesota Recovery Connection, for example, is the largest trainer of peer recovery specialists in Minnesota. Everything that we offer is free to our communities, and our services typically include one-to-one peer recovery coaching, systems navigation, linkages to housing, employment, healthcare, and a lot of ways recovery community organizations are similar to local department stores for recovery. And Minnesota has 9 recovery community organizations right now. Minnesota Recovery Connection, which I represent, is the oldest. We've been around since 2010. There are 2 recovery community organizations in Rochester, 1 in Mankato, 1 in St. Cloud, 1 in Duluth, and there are 4 in the Twin Cities, 2 of which are culturally specific to the African American community. The impact of COVID-19 has really increased the awareness of peer recovery support services from other agencies. We have, in the past year, each of the recovery community organizations in our in Minnesota has found themselves entering into more one-to-one partnerships with local organizations and counties. And I'm not sure if that's connected specifically to COVID-19 or also kind of the timing of increased awareness of peer recovery support services in Minnesota. So we find ourselves working primarily in non-clinical spaces, working with county children and family services departments, working with county jails, working with hospitals and emergency rooms, working with schools, and working with other community-based organizations. And it's in this context of direct delivery of peer recovery support services that we are being particularly effective in helping to connect people to other support services and also to help minimize the harm of substance use disorder. So these one-to-one connections with other community organizations have really started to bring peer recovery support into other spaces, and we're excited to see where that is going. We overall have seen about a 40% increase in demand for our support services across all of the RCOs. And so that includes not just individuals seeking us out for support. Again, all of our support is free. It's all delivered by individuals who are peers, people with lived experience with substance use disorder and recovery, and who have been trained as peer recovery specialists. Our organizations are all led by members of the community. And the services are delivered by members of the community. I myself am a person in long-term recovery from substance use disorder. So we deliver these free support services, which can look like one-to-one coaching over an extended period of time. It can be episodic. It can be a one-time call. We also assertively reach out to individuals who sign up to get a check-in call from us once a week. We frequently get calls from family members and concerned others who are at a loss of where to even begin in the recovery journey. And we've noticed not just an increase in people reaching out to us, but extended use of support. So conversations, used to be fairly brief, often now last half an hour, 30 minutes. All of the RCOs quickly converted their services to virtual platforms, using increased use of phone and Zoom platforms. As others have indicated in these presentations, that has mixed results. We individually have gained some new audiences because of that. For example, Minnesota Recovery Connection, which is situated in St. Paul, we now get people connecting with us from greater Minnesota where there isn't, where there aren't RCOs, particularly in northwestern Minnesota, Bemidji, Brainerd, that area. But we've also lost people. All of the RCOs are drop-in centers. We are adamant about accepting anyone at any time who just needs to come in and get some non-stigmatizing peer support. We've all had to shut down or limit our on-site operations. And so I don't need to repeat some of what others have said about the challenges of telehealth, but also the benefits of telehealth. It's a mixed bag. Many of the RCOs are doing increased street outreach. Particularly, I want to give a shout out to Twin Cities Recovery Project and Continuum Care Center, who are the two African-American governed and led RCOs in the Twin Cities, have been doing extensive outreach in the encampments and other parts of the Twin Cities, providing peer support and distributing Narcan and doing everything they can to try to connect people to supportive recovery services and environments. So I have one quote here, which has been pretty typical of our experience, is that we do hear from people that we are saving lives. And we hear from folks that having access to peer support, the non-judgmental, all pathways support that meets people where they're at and helps to connect them to other services is really critical in this time. And we're excited to see where our work in these other spaces might lead to more de-escalation of crisis situations. So I'll pause there and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. I see Representative Thompson has a question. Representative Thompson, go ahead, please.
Thank you so much, Chair Fisher. I did hear part of my question answered when she talked about, when Commissioner talked about the Twin Cities Recovery Act. I am familiar with that organization. I do have a large Hmong Somalian African-American population and community, in my district. There's a lot that I could say was missed when we tried to do outreach in those communities. There's a lot that was missed. I know we can do a better job. Prior to this COVID pandemic, and the George Floyd. Prior to that, we knew nothing about Twin Cities recovery, and there wasn't a concentrated effort to target or to bring support and some of the support needed. And Lord knows we need mental health specialists and behavioral health centers and trainings and all these beautiful things in my community, but we missed. It seems like we missed the east side of St. Paul and parts of Minneapolis. And I just wanted to know, can we try a little harder to bring some of these services that are flourishing in other communities to my community?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Thompson. I agree 100%. Recovery community organizations are grassroots. We're scrappy, small nonprofits who piece together our funding from a variety of sources. And it is our goal to try to get as many of these community centers as possible. We don't have an overarching infrastructure. So one of the characteristics of recovery community organizations is that they grow out of the needs of their specific communities. So MRC, for example, has been very supportive of the development of Twin Cities Recovery Project and other RCOs. One of the things we do struggle with is recognition. So it's we're still sort of a new kid on the block, and it's we don't have a lot of resources to publicize our services. We are working, MRC is working right now with the Frogtown Recovery Cafe, which is an emerging RCO on the east side. Sherry Lemma is leading that. And we are distinctly aware of the gap in services. MRC recently hired on a full-time Somali peer recovery specialist, Faria Budul, who is doing, she's just beginning some extensive outreach in the East African community in Minneapolis. And so we are just extremely aware of the urgency and moving as fast as we can. And we appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. I do not see Representative Thompson's hand up anymore, so I'm going to make the assumption that he has no further questions. With that, the next person I have on the list is Representative Mohler. Representative Mohler, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering about this as you were presenting, and then Representative Thompson's question sort of fed into what I was wondering about, and that was faith-based communities, if you do any outreach through different faith communities. And then my other question was related to language barriers. You did talk just about the Somali peer support, but wondering if you could address some other languages that you encounter.
Ms. Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Mohler. Again, each recovery community organization is specific to its community. I can only speak on behalf of Minnesota Recovery Connection in terms of our specific services to outreach. We conduct outreach everywhere. This has been particularly limited during COVID-19. We have not done targeted outreach at faith-based communities, so I appreciate that suggestion. We honor all pathways and recognize that for many people, faith is a pathway that is particularly effective for them. So we do have collaborative relationships with many faith-based groups, but we haven't made that a strategic priority to do outreach to faith-based communities. So I appreciate that suggestion. Individual languages where there is need, and particularly Spanish, there's a real dearth of recovery support services available in Spanish right now. And I know that CLUES has a behavioral health program and is working to build its capacity to provide peer recovery support services in that language. Recovery Community Network in St. Cloud does have a Spanish-speaking, a bilingual peer recovery specialist. Again, we have a bilingual peer recovery specialist who speaks Somali, but it's pretty hit or miss right now, depending on the individual RCO. And that, again, is part of our long range plan, is to try to build that capacity, collaborating with communities and partners. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. I see Representative Mohler has lowered her hand, so I will then go to Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Jones, for your work, especially in this time when it's especially needed. I believe if I heard you correctly, you said that telehealth and teleconnections are kind of a mixed bag. That and I believe Mr. Hunter alluded to this as well. And it's, I imagine it's like meeting remotely as legislators. There are things that we can do meeting remotely, and we're also realizing there are things that are more difficult trying to do our work through this platform. So I'm wondering if you can talk more about the benefits of telehealth. And I know it's been extremely important, but I'm wondering if you can also talk some about what is more difficult, or perhaps what is missing. I think, a big question for all of us is, what will we keep be holding on to during this time, and what will we have to pull back from the ways that we've operated before.
Great. Ms. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lippert. To echo what many have said, addiction is a disease of isolation, and there is something about that physical connection, that being together in person, that is extremely powerful. Beyond that, we have discovered that the challenges and the benefits of telehealth, the challenge being that not everyone is familiar with how to access Zoom. And we found it difficult for some of our participants to use that technology, even if they do have a phone. The other challenge is the space in which the telehealth occurs. So for many people, the benefit of actually physically going somewhere and being able to have that private time, for lack of a better expression, with someone to support you has been, we realized just how critical that is. To give an example of, you know, one of the functions of our RCO is to provide training, you know, to help build the recovery capital of our community by training them as peer recovery specialists. We've converted our training to a Zoom platform, an interactive Zoom platform. Extremely difficult to have people find a space where they're not interrupted. Many are managing children, managing the other distractions of their lives, or they don't have a space. A significant percentage of the folks that we train are experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. So they don't have that kind of environment in which to even engage in telehealth. So the security that you need and the sophistication of experience with technology that you need to engage with most forms of telehealth as we perceive it from recovery community organizations is quite frequently missing. And that's a segment of the population that RCOs are particularly adept at reaching, because we, again, are not a clinical provider, and we're all, you know, we provide that peer support. So I would just emphasize again, that's been the considerable challenge. But at the same time, Minnesota is a big state, and there are only 9 RCOs. There are none in much of Western Minnesota. And so as we've been able to publicize some resources that are available, you know, through these digital platforms, we have been able to connect with people who weren't connecting with us before. And so we see it as a yes and, you know, moving forward, we really plan to diversify our offerings and integrate, you know, it's just like good education. You need to be multimodal and have a lot of different ways to reach people. So I think we're all planning to have a better integrated set of services.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. I don't see any hands up for further. Representative Lippert, did you have any further questions?
No, Mr. Chair. I did notice that Mr. Hunter unmuted himself for a moment. I didn't know if he wanted to jump in as well or not.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Mr. Hunter. We'll take Mr. Hunter, then I'll go to Representative Thompson for his questions that he has. Just give a order because we're starting to get to less than half hour left. So I'll go to, after Mr. Hunter, I'll go to questions from Representative Thompson, and then I will go back to our presenters for the rest of the presentation, then take any remaining questions after that. So Mr. Hunter, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Yeah, just briefly, we talk about a number of methodologies and modalities that don't lend itself well. I think that was kind of the question to the telehealth piece. And I would say a couple things that came to my head right away. One is things like armed services are very skill-based services. When we're working with folks in their homes on things of daily activity, living skills, cooking, cleaning, how to just maintain everyday life, very difficult to do via telehealth, right, when we should be there. I also would say assessing for crisis services and other services. We've made it work via telehealth, but when you're in somebody's environment, you can do a much more robust assessment of those individuals and their environment and their care settings than you can via telehealth. Like I said, we can make it work, but the preferred methodology is usually in person. Okay. But again, it does increase that access to our rural areas.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Next, I'll go to Representative Thompson for his questions. Go ahead, Representative Thompson.
Chair Fisher, excuse me, but I was not trying to raise my hand. I apologize.
No, that's okay. Thank you. All right. Appreciate that. Next person, so we'll go on with the presentations then. Please hold, I'd ask members of the committee to please hold their questions until we finish. Next person I have is Ms. Anderson from Aspire. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and who you're with and start with your presentation. Thank you, Ms. Anderson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson, and I'm the executive director of Aspire Minnesota. We are a statewide association of children service providers, and it's an honor to be with you today and with this august group of presenters. So we have learned a tremendous amount of things through the pandemic, and we continue to learn. We're just going to highlight a few items. One is that mental health care must be considered as part of our larger healthcare system, including frontline service responses. This requires strong coordination with all sectors and systems, including education, public safety, healthcare, housing, and criminal justice. From the initial days of the pandemic through today, identifying and supporting mental health care as a critical component of each system has been fundamental to sustaining care. I'll also just note that we've all been very deeply collaborating, those of us on this call today, folks from the Department of Human Services and the administration, Department of Health, and beyond. And it's required that to sustain mental health care delivery across the board, as well as behavioral health, that wider array of services. And so collaboration is key. And one of those examples popped to mind as Representative Mueller's question came up earlier. We appreciate the administration actually took action to sustain care for those mental health professionals that live outside of Minnesota's borders. There needed to be some flexibility from Minnesota's licensing boards to allow those who work here but live outside of our borders to sustain care for clients within Minnesota. And some of those licensing board exceptions are simply not yet shared with other states, and it just represents one more complexity of our system. Telehealth is a learning, and one we anticipate to be sustained because it's brought tremendous benefit, sustained services in this time of pandemic, and additional benefit in being able to respond to barriers. So we have conducted a survey of clients of our member organizations who serve children and families across the state. So the survey was conducted at the end of May, and 930 clients responded across 54 counties. Feedback was really indicative of what was happening at the time and continues to. A lot of commentary about the critical nature of sustaining those relationships with our mental health therapists, the skills-based support that was able to be sustained through telehealth platforms, and then also addressing some of the barriers that prevent access to care, like transportation, childcare, and other elements that make in-person service delivery really challenging. And then just statistically, it works. 88% of those surveyed responded they personally were experiencing a therapeutic benefit from telehealth, and 61% at that time said that they would choose telehealth post-pandemic. Of course, at the end of May, we thought that would be sooner than it continues to be. We also know from commentary you've heard today and other times that bridging the technological divide remains a very top priority for all of us. Access to hardware and to broadband is critical. And so reflecting that need and priority we share, we also have seen a great reliance on phone care, phone access to sustain critical therapies in those cases where video-based platforms or other essential parts of the video-based or the technology equation are simply not available. And as it's been mentioned, telehealth doesn't work for everyone. Certain populations, including some of our smallest kiddos, some day treatment clients, those lacking private spaces, and those whose individual needs simply require in-person therapy, it reminds us that telehealth has been, and we anticipate will continue to be, a critical innovation that sustains and delivers key services. And for some, it's been an emergency bridge. We also know that we've learned a lot about in-person service challenges as intensive residential, day treatment, in-home, and some clinic-based care has sustained through the pandemic. These services have adapted and innovated and have required use of PPE, enhanced cleaning, and enhanced staffing costs. And that has yielded pretty significant costs of care. I think that it's important to note, as you all have, I'm sure, that there have been really tremendous losses in our space, meaning that there's been significant costs that haven't been recovered. And so there's been a lot of efforts to respond to the need to strengthen our and sustain our infrastructure as we seek to continue to deliver care during this very difficult time. We also have seen great innovation and mutual support between providers and our wider community around ideas like walk and talks, outdoor engagement, and ways to safely sustain family visits and engagement despite some of our pandemic risks. So outside and now increasingly during the colder temperatures, ways that families can safely be together in indoor spaces. Finally, one of the other things that we have heard and seen is simply a higher level of acuity from referrals across the board and regression in some clients. So one example of that is we've seen more day treatment services opened, reopening and opening new capacity based on simply the great demand for care for intensive day treatment. And then again, providers have reported that throughout the continuum from clinic-based to residential treatment and all the continuum in between, referrals are reflecting, again, enhanced acuity and some regression from clients as that they've been experiencing the tremendous pressures of this pandemic. And with that, I'm glad to pass the mic to Ms. Jen Lee Palin.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Anderson. Ms. Jenny Palin, if you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself and who you're with and continue the presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jenny Palin. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We are a state association of 32 community mental health programs, including the vast majority of the state's community mental health centers in Minnesota. And picking up where Ms. Anderson finished the slide, we're also, as providers and safety net facilities, seeing a sharp increase in the utilization of helplines, warm lines, classes, and support groups as folks are starting to deal more with some of the symptoms from the onset and resulting symptoms of the pandemic and some of those results. School-linked mental health services have consistently been one of the most challenging services to sustain in this pandemic, and that is with the inclusion of the broader telemedicine flexibilities. A lot of this is in combination with the fact that school has also turned into a hybrid of remote, hybrid, and in-person settings, and also very reliant on our ability to use virtual platforms. And so our providers are seeing lost engagement through these virtual platforms, teleconference fatigue from both children and their families, and mounting disruptions of services and decreased accessibility. All of these challenges really are impacting our providers' ability to engage with families, to engage with school staff, providers' ability to keep schedules full, and that all really impacts the ability to meet reimbursement targets that are necessary to sustain programs in this fee-for-service payment model. Community mental health programs have sustained some major losses throughout the pandemic to the SchoolLink program in particular. And while this is a big challenge, we have been in conversations with the Department of Human Services and with the Department of Education, and who are very aware of this. And we are very grateful that we hear there are conversations around a proposal for some relief funding and some other proposals to start to address some of these underlying issues. And really it is that providers and programs are needing some foundational changes to this model's underlying mechanism as it currently is being operated. One other area that we have really seen, or an outcome of the pandemic, is that our mental health system infrastructure is very fragile, but providers are very resilient. And this is similar to what some of our colleagues ahead of me had noted in their presentations. Providers are forming private-public partnerships with corporate entities, with their community organizations, and with the state, and have shown that they can really shift the way they're delivering care on a dime under the need of this pandemic. However, the pandemic has also put a spotlight on the existing gaps and issues in our system that we over time have been able to patch up. But now we're really seeing that we need to have some pretty significant reforms to the underlying foundation and the infrastructure of our mental health system. And from our perspective, that really includes addressing outpatient behavioral health rates in our Medicaid system, moving forward with uniform service standards so that our providers have so that the regulations are updated and providers are all clear, and that there is a practice now that regulations that follow the current practice of how our industry is moving, needing to address voluntary placement for children in residential programs, and also needing to address licensing and recertification requirements that have been eased over the course of the pandemic. And now we're seeing that as we are not quite out of the woods yet, needing to really think through some of the long-term sustainability challenges that some of these requirements are putting on our providers, and including the issue that we're running into right now around background studies and getting our folks, our workforce, able to provide services. And we recognize that this is a big topic, and it's not something that the Department of Human Services Behavioral Health Division can address alone, and that there are many conversations around this, but it is an example of an issue that's adding to the workforce challenges in the behavioral health space. And with all of that, providers and our community mental health programs are really hopeful that this committee, the legislature, and the department are prioritizing behavioral health in the way that you all are, and really putting a great deal of focus in wanting to move forward these reforms and addressing these concerns. And we really appreciate that, and we look forward to partnering with you as we move forward.
Thank you, Ms. Palin. At this point, we will be circling back to the department. They have the telemedicine study findings to review and some policy ideas that they'll be dealing with us. We've got exactly 15 minutes left, so we want to make sure this is quicker. And then I do know that we have Representative Backer who also has a question there. So I will turn it over to, I'm not too sure who in the department will start us off. If you'd like to identify yourself and go ahead with the telemedicine study findings, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is Nija Singh. I'm the Clinical Director for Community Support Administration, and I will be talking briefly about the telemedicine study findings. I want to emphasize that when we started this study, we were not expecting pandemic to go this long. Just as Mr. Chair and members, you guys are all aware that we had to make a lot of variations in our service delivery model to make sure that people are getting services. So we added a lot of flexibility with the hope that once the pandemic is done, we will be able to gauge the effectiveness of these modalities. Pandemic is still here. I just want to clarify the terminology that we are using when we are talking about telemedicine. Given all the flexibilities we have, Mr. Chair, they are not HIPAA compliant, CFR 42 compliant modalities. They are not secure modalities right now. These standards are dictated by Office of Civil Rights and our CMS at the federal level. Given the pandemic has extended so long, CMS as well as OCR, our Office of Civil Rights, have been really quiet on continuation of utilization of non-secure modalities like use of telephone. So this study, as you'll see on your slide, it showed that there was easier access to care. We were able to involve, the providers were able to involve the family members in health services. There was a spike in utilization of telehealth from February to April, and then it went down because more and more providers were able to open their offices. However, Minnesota's data, and we are still analyzing, showed that we did really well as compared to national standards, as far as access to telemedicine for our population above 65 and below 6 is concerned. And one of the reasons we are thinking is that we are like very heavily family focused system. So our families were able to engage more utilizing telemedicine as compared to some of our other clients. However, use of telemedicine, as our partners pointed out, it has a lot of limitations. It doesn't work for all clients. We have a lot of concerns regarding infrastructure. Next slide, please. So we have a lot of concerns regarding infrastructure, and that's why some of the recommendations of this study are that we keep telemedicine for medical assistance enrollees after the pandemic is done. However, we need to develop specific guidance as well as like infrastructure for our providers in terms of training and education on telemedicine. We are conducting focus groups right now with the providers to explore the utilization of telephone only modality, because that is like, as some of our partners pointed out, that it is really helpful in reaching some of the clients who we were not in the past. However, it's not the best way. I want to emphasize, and then I will pass it on to Mr. Fleisler, is that we want to really conduct a study on effectiveness of utilization of telemedicine once the pandemic is over, so we have data to compare. Because right now, even when we are looking at outcomes, we don't know how much of this is due to pandemic. So with that, I am going to pass it on to Mr. Fleisner.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Fleisner, if you'd like to go ahead, we have 10 minutes left, and we still have questions out there, too.
All right.
Mr. Fleisner.
Chair Fisher and members, I'll be quick. We have three policy ideas I wanted to share with you. One, which is a major access issue, is wanting to continue to allow psychiatric care provider services for both assertive community treatment and intensive rehabilitative mental health services to be provided by telemedicine. As you heard earlier, that's been a major access improvement. The second one is DHS contracts with almost all of Minnesota's 87 counties and three American Indian Child Welfare Initiative tribal nations to provide mental health screenings of child welfare and juvenile justice populations. The purpose of those screenings is to integrate mental health into current practices and to promote earlier mental health needs, identification, and intervention. We want the ability to collect individual screening results of children who participate in those screenings for the purposes of program evaluation improvement, so we have better outcomes. Currently, statute prohibits us from collecting individual screening results. We really want to understand the gaps, access issues, and disparities in our system. And lastly, there are some modifications needed to ensure that adequate grant administration for the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council happens. We seek to clarify grant management requirements, update the allowance for grant administration, and align the grant reporting timeline with when grants are proposed to be awarded by the council. Thank you very much. I will pass it, or I will pass it on to Dr. Singh or take questions as you see fit.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Singh, any final comments that you have?
I will just add, Mr. Chair and members, that there is a group, it's called Medicaid Forward. That's a national level group comprising 8 states, and it is working on reviewing all the stipulations around telemedicine, what can be done to increase access. But one more thing this group is working at the national level, Mr. Chair, is to analyze and provide resources to the providers who are also experiencing a lot of vicarious trauma due to pandemic. So providers' needs and their mental health well-being is very much a focus of this group. With that.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Singh. Okay, we will now go to questions. Representative Backer, you have your hand up first. Why don't you go ahead, sir?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And this is really to any of the presenters who would be able to answer this. You know, we've heard that some of the behavioral health issues are served well with telemedicine, telehealth, and others are not served as well. From your experience, which of the behavioral health has worked well with telemedicine and which have not, you know, and I would like to know that. Is there a difference in what's working well in, you know, is more the rural, greater Minnesota area compared to the metro? So that would be my chair, and any of the presenters can tackle that. I would appreciate that, whoever could share that with me. Thank you for us.
Okay, that's up for people to answer. If somebody would like to, I see Ms. Delwo is offering to start that discussion off. If you'd like to go ahead, Ms. Delwo, and we'll see if anyone else has anything to answer add after you're done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Amy Delwo, and thank you for the question. I think that what we have found is actually people are at different places in their recovery, and that there are times where they have to establish their connection, if you will, with the counselor and those relationships. And once that has happened, that really the counselors, we kind of leave that up to their professional insight about how they manage remote sessions effectively. And if I could just share a quick minute, We did, I mentioned the study earlier. We've enrolled 2,500 people in the study, New Way and University of Minnesota. And in terms of the outcomes that people are experiencing, those that have a mixed modality, which is in-person as well as televideo, we only did televideo, showed comparable outcomes in anxiety, depression, coping skills, self-care, and positive relationships. But surprisingly, those that had a mixed modality outperformed both in-person and televideo only in substance use, days in treatment, treatment completion, regular outcome, and money management and positive outlook. And I think that one of those things is it allows that flexibility for clients to be able to kind of manage the other parts of their life.
Thank you. I see Ms. Abderholden, I'll go to you. We've got 5 minutes left, and Representative Frankie still has a question too. Go ahead, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So telemedicine is great, but it doesn't work for everyone. Young children cannot connect on the screen. It's not like watching a Disney movie, and so they can't really engage in a way that's useful. You have other kids who just can't sit still for an hour watching on a screen and doing therapy. You have teenagers that want to be in a room by themselves, so not everybody's hearing what they're talking about and things like that. And then when you add in people who don't have access to technology, who don't have good internet, those all become barriers as well. But I really want to emphasize that with kids, it is more difficult than with adults. Still useful, but it doesn't work for everyone.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. I will now go to Representative Frankie. If you'd like to go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Quite a bit to go over here, but one of the reoccurring things that I'm hearing is, the types and amounts of facilities that we have in all our different areas and districts. I was wondering if Commissioner Fleischner, and I don't know who he would direct this to, but would be able to get us maybe a map or a list of the types of facilities or services that are offered in our communities, because I don't even know all the different types of services and facilities in my district. I mean, I work with and am, in contact with certain different treatment facilities and stuff like that because of my background. But I think it would be nice to know where we have it, so that we can address a lot of those underserved communities, and then also so that we can direct people that may come to us for some type of an assistance and point them in the right direction. So just to make it easier, we can just focus on straight up accredited facilities and what types of services they offer outside of maybe just the county service center. It's always easy for us just to point to the county and be like, go to the county, they'll help you. But just for our own knowledge of what we have within our districts and what we may potentially be able to pass off to people asking questions who may need some type of assistance. That's my question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. I will go to Mr. Fleischner for that. We have less than 2 minutes. So Mr. Fleischner, if you can hit that real quickly.
Yeah, Chair Fisher, Representative Frankie, I think that's a great question. I know it would be a good resource, and we will work on getting those maps to you. Between us, I think, and the provider associations, we can put some information together that I think would be helpful.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fleischner. I want to say also thank you to all of our presenters today and to the members for the discussion we've had. Next week, we're going to be discussing Minnesota's mental health hospital bed network and capacity challenges we are facing statewide. For anyone who is watching today's hearing and has an interest in that topic, I strongly encourage you to reach out to our committee staff about testifying next week to share any insights that you or your organization may have. We will get that hearing notice shortly with more details on how to sign up with that. And also would like to remind the general public, if there's anyone in the public that had any comments that they would like to share today, that you have 24 hours to be able to submit that to our committee staff, and that we can share that with the committee and have that posted. I want to thank everyone once again for being here. And with that, we are adjourned.